Texas has always had a reputation for carrying out executions, and one man's testimony made many of them possible. He claimed he could predict the future dangerousness of an offender with absolute certainty, even if they had never met. And time after time, juries believed him. This week's episode is The Death Penalty's Accomplice, Dr. James Grigson.
A bump in the night, your heart fills with dread. Probably a murderer who wants you dead. It could be a ghost, a demon, or worse. Perhaps you're the victim of a witch's curse. It's hopeless, you're doomed, you'd call a priest if you could. You'd rather just listen to who? Sinister Hood.
I'm gonna kill you. Well, we're talking about a Texas, not even a case, it's a series of cases, but a Texas became a criminal justice legend, quite literally. Legends aren't always good, right?
Yeah. Yeah, infamous.
Yeah.
It was an infamous legend. Unfortunately, our state is well known for giving out the death penalty, and a lot of executions have gone on here, sadly.
Most definitely. And we'll kind of bring it around to like the current state, as well as kind of like how the death penalty came about. But we'll, you'll hear this guy was in it, in the thick of it, right when executions started again, and became this go-to person, such that as an attorney, you know, we hear about him, you hear, read articles about him, or have just a brief reference of, you know, someone like this person, and you're like, oh, well, who's that? I want to know more about him. So we decided to do a whole episode so all of y'all know about this person and what he did.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's when money gets involved and you want to be the expert in something, shit goes sideways a lot of times.
Yeah. You kind of see what the impetus somebody might have to testify a certain way or whatever as we go through this. But like you said, you got a Texas hat on right now. We try to be proud of the proud parts of our state. And this is, but I think we also don't want to look away and go, oh, it's going to make us look real bad. It's
no.
Like, it makes us look how we look because it was a true thing that we did.
You can't deny what's facts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do have a Texas hat on because did not wash my hair today. So well, I also like the color of it. So.
Mine is just a lot of dry. I have a hat of dry shampoo. So that's I would say the
when
problem.
You like can
but
feel, it's like,
it's hard. It's a helmet.
You touch it.
Yeah. I like helmet. Bonk against the wall and I'm like, I'm fine. I'm totally fine. That's one of the, I'll say an added element for us to consider with recording now. Cause it used to be just our hovels alone in the dark and we could look like anything. And now you all see us on YouTube. So speaking of actually seeing us on YouTube, that's a good segue into one of the announcements we want to make. Hello, if you're watching us on YouTube, first of all, go and subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's totally free and you can watch this that you're listening to. We try to get them out as soon as possible, but we're like a small shop. So sometimes it's within several days of the episode coming out. They are ad free on Patreon, but they're totally free for you to watch the whole video version on our YouTube channel. But we also live stream sometimes.
We do. We live stream sometimes and we've got a new type of live stream that's going to be coming to you all Sunday nights, 8 p.m. Central, 8:30. We're filming at my house and the kids go to bed around 7:38, so maybe an 8:30 Central time. But we're calling it Sunday Scaries, and we are asking for you all to send us your scary, weird, or hilarious videos, and we are going to live react to them.
So yeah, if you have like something creepy you caught on camera, if you found a weird and unexplainable clip online, either it's a mystery or just like this is funny and weird and funky and we want you to see, y'all want us to see it. Or if you have a funny video that you think we would think is funny and want to share with everyone, it's like a way for us to get together, watch stuff. We like to live react because we're improvisers. So whatever we're going to say is just like off the top of our heads because we've never seen this before. Tommy is going to take your submissions and curate them for us. Bless him for doing that. So if you have any of those things or whatever it is, err on the side of sending it in. And then that way Tommy can vet it.
We'll figure it out as we go along. Yeah. We're all going to figure it out together.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that if you're listening to us, you know what our brand is and things that we not want to watch.
Yes.
That's why we have our screener, Tommy, that is unflappable. So you can send him basically anything and it won't faze him, but he will vet it before it gets to us.
Exactly. So go to sinisterhood.com/scaries, S-C-A-R-I-E-S. And there's also a banner link on our homepage. So you can click it. And it's just a Google form, pretty easy for you to plunk in your name, a link, and you can put a description if you want to, or just send it with no description. It's fine as well. And let us just live and react Sunday nights. Like you said, we'll say 8:30 central. That way we're not bumping up against bedtime for you or for our listeners too, over on our YouTube channel at Sinisterhood Podcast. The next one is February 16th. So mark your calendars and send those videos in now at sinisterhood.com/scaries.
Yes. Thank you all. But I'm very excited about this.
It's gonna be fun.
And I think it's going to be super fun. We also have another super fun announcement that,
yes,
we are honored to make.
Cannot wait. If you've ever wanted to solve a mystery with us at sea while sipping pina coladas and possibly, or most definitely, encountering unidentified submersible objects or alien bases, I don't know, we've got very good news for you.
We do, because we are participating in Crime Wave at Sea 2025, a one-of-a-kind true crime festival. It's happening this November 3rd to 7th. We can't wait. Picture this, your favorite creators live on stage, exclusive collaborations, fan meetups, activities designed to connect you with other true crime fans.
And as an added bonus, we are sailing straight through the Bermuda Triangle.
Nice.
That's why, I mean, we're excited about Crime Wave. The whole deal sounds great. But then we saw the map and we're like, do you think we could slip between dimensions by doing this? And they're like, we don't know how to answer that question. We're a cruise company, but.
And we said, well, we'll talk to the captain.
We'll take it.
When we get on board. So yeah. Thank you very much. We each have a captain's hat.
Yes, we're going to wear them. Like we're technically, actually, we have admiral's hats, which is higher than a captain. Ooh. So they have to let us drive the ship.
Well,
absolutely.
We rank above them. So we're going straight into another dimension as soon as we get there. Plus, I've said it before, octopuses, aliens, prove me wrong. You can't. And this is your chance to possibly meet one on neutral territory. And by neutral, we mean their watery domain where they have the upper hand.
Tentacles? Man, we're going to get a whoosh on our window and it's just an octopus sucker. And they're like, I'm here. You're like, finally! Like
Lost with Charlie, and it just says,
Penny,
not
let me in the boat.
Kraken's boat. Yeah.
Not Kraken's boat. Well, tickets for this incredible experience go on sale February 7th at noon Eastern time, but act fast because spaces are limited. First, you've got to head to crimewaveatsea.com/sinister. Starting now, grab your fan code. And remember, you have to have a fan code to get your ticket, so don't miss out.
Fan code, then tickets. That's yes. The order of operations. In addition to live shows, panels, and true crime fan meetups, you'll also get classic cruise perks like endless food, mm-hmm. exotic destinations, and the potential existential terror of being surrounded by miles of open ocean.
I look forward to questioning my reality, certainly. It's just, I mean, it's worth it to say you vacation with us. And it's not just us. It is some of the coolest creators in the true crime space, including Henry and Ed from Last Podcast Side Stories, Dan and Linz from Scared to Death, and Katie and Whitney from True Crime Campfire. It's a killer lineup. We cannot wait to hang out with all these awesome people and perform and do other stuff too. I don't know all we're going to do.
It's going to be all sorts of
can't
fun
wait.
Stuff.
We can't wait.
Plus, and we know, there's like a bunch of stuff to do on a cruise ship that doesn't even involve us.
Get your shuffleboard on, baby. You don't need me for that. Get your shuffleboard on all day.
Go down that water slide a million times and set your reminders to join us for Crime Wave at Sea 2025. Don't forget to use the hashtag Crime Wave 2025 so we can see all your posts about the inevitable strange lights that we're all going to capture in the night sky.
This is how we're about to see a drone, for real, for real. It's unforgettable. We will see you
drone,
on
alien,
the ship.
Yes, something.
We're going to see you on the ship or the mothership. Time will tell. time will tell. But we're excited about all that. So thank y'all for indulging us with our announcements up here at the top. Before we dive into forensic psychiatry, death penalty law, all kinds
wrongful
of stuff.
Wrongful convictions.
Yes.
It's a,
doozy.
We're taking a hard turn.
Yeah, hard turn.
Turn alert, we're turning.
We're hard part to starboard, which is right, I think.
Starboard and.
Port is left.
Port side.
Starboard is right. Yeah, so hard to right. Starboard.
Yes. Well, I'm Christy.
I'm Heather.
And let's get into it. Dr. James Paul Grigson, known infamously as Dr. Death, was a forensic psychiatrist whose career was defined by his controversial testimony in capital murder trials. Born on January 30th, 1932 in Texarkana, Texas, Grigson excelled academically and was well-liked in high school, where he was named Best All-Around Boy in 1949. He attended Texarkana Community College before transferring to Texas A&M University, where he completed his bachelor's degree. He then pursued a medical degree from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas, later specializing in forensic psychiatry.
Texarkana is a small town in East Texas, and as the name implies, if you're not from here, Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana all come together in this area. And
they got that one.
They just mashed the names up.
It's like Alabama.
Yeah, exactly. But on like the name of the sign for a town, they went with it. They
kept
it.
The bar.
No, they kept it. But his family had some money because they had the Rock of Ages franchise, which was a special type of marble that in the time when he was growing up, like in the 30s, it was very coveted to bury your family under a Rock of Ages marble. And they were the only ones allowed to sell it in that 4-state area between Arkansas, Louisiana, I want to say maybe Oklahoma and Texas. And so that's how they made money. But he comes from like this death family.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like true. Yeah. It's on when you grow up and that's your family business, perhaps it warps the mind a bit.
It does. But I like to be best all around boy. It's like, you're just, as far as boys go, good job.
It's what is it? Mother boy?
Oh, yeah. On Arrested Development.
What is the competition called?
Mother Boy 30. Mother and I have dressed together. Best all around Mother Boy.
Like sailors. Oh, man.
But yeah, he liked to play poker, chess at a steel trap mine. So it's like not surprising that he went into like a super hard field like that.
Yeah, all those are very good schools too.
Yeah.
Gregson's career in forensic psychiatry began in 1961 when he conducted his first criminal psychiatric evaluation. By 1963, he had received his first court appointment at the Dallas County Courthouse while working full-time as a professor of psychiatry at Southwestern Medical School, where he taught for 4 years. In 1967, Gregson left academia and entered private practice, initially focusing on competency evaluations. Conducted before a trial but after an indictment, these evaluations were meant to determine if individuals were mentally fit to stand trial. Gregson later used the information gathered in these assessments against the same defendants during the penalty phase of capital murder trials. This practice allowed Gregson to argue for a defendant's future dangerousness using the defendant's own statements or behavior observed during the competency evaluation. In 1974, the doctor followed this routine with Ernest Benjamin Smith, who was convicted of capital murder.
So I think it's, you know, kind of unfair if the person is assessing you to see if you can aid in your own defense and then gets you to tell him a bunch of secrets and everything. And then that same person takes all your secrets after you've been convicted and tells the jury, do you want to know a bunch of different secrets based on these things? I think he's really horrible. And it's like, well, that should be two different people's jobs.
It's like confessing to your priest. And then the next day at mass, he stands up and he's like, have I got some news for all of you?
Like the rabbi on Seinfeld that was like, a friend I'll call Elaine. It's like, that's her real name. Like, you're using this real information. Mm-hmm. But the 70s were a loose time.
Definitely. Especially in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
The evolution of death penalty laws in Texas during the bulk of Dr. Gregson's practice from 1970 to 1990 was shaped by landmark legal developments and constitutional challenges. In 1972, U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Furman v. Georgia struck down existing death penalty statutes nationwide, including in Texas, for granting excessive discretion to juries, effectively halting executions. Texas responded by enacting a revised capital punishment statute in 1973, requiring juries to answer three, quote, special issues at the penalty phase of trials. One, whether the crime was deliberate. Two, whether there was a probability the defendant would commit future acts of violence. And three, whether the defendant was provoked. This approach was upheld by the Supreme Court in Jurek v. Texas in 1976, which found the system constitutional because it guided jury discretion and allowed for individualized sentencing.
Yeah, the Supreme Court said you can't just have a jury that sort of like eyeballs it and gut check decides that like
That's probably good.
Yeah. And so instead, Texas was like, oh, so we shouldn't have any executions? No, we'll just write a new law so that we can still keep killing people.
Yeah. That's the thing. What's the point of a law when you can just write a law to undo it?
Oh, yeah. Or just make a new one. Certainly. Yeah. I mean, this is at least a little bit better framework, but we're going to hear as every time it's a game of attrition, right? It's like you pass a law and then there's always somebody that finds out how to exploit that law. So it's like, it's really good. We have a framework. Well, let's watch.
We're dealing with that every minute of the day right now.
Right.
Laws just like being undone and things being written to undo all the progress.
Mm-hmm.
Question two, which centered on future dangerousness and the probability that a defendant would kill again, came Gregson's primary area of expertise. In 1974, he testified as much about Ernest Benjamin Smith, saying with absolute certainty that the defendant was a severe sociopath and would unquestionably kill again, even in prison. Throughout the late 1970s, he continued testifying in similar ways, using information he learned about defendants in competency exams to condemn them to death. In other cases, he never interviewed the defendants at all.
And imagine you're
crazy to me.
Yes, yes, yes.
Dude, you can't just say this stuff He's because like, you're like, well, I have a feeling. No,
I'm a doctor.
Not when somebody's life's on the line,
no.
Sir.
Or I'm a doctor, trust me. I've seen him like him before. It's like, what are you talking about? You're like, are you a medium, an oracle? Like,
yeah.
How are you just like, I just... No. And that's, imagine then you're a jury, you're a lay person, you're sitting there and they're like, for the first 15 minutes of the testimony, it's like, okay, Dr. Gregson, where did you go to school? Well, I went to Texas A&M where I majored in this. Oh, and then you went to medical school. Okay. And then where did you practice? And then where did you, so you're just like stacking these credentials, which the jury's eyes glaze over after a minute. And they're just like, yada, yada, yada. He's an expert. What do you want me to listen to him about? And then he goes, that man will 100% kill again. And if you all don't agree with me, dot, dot, dot. So the jury's like, well, I mean, the doctor said he was going to kill again. So that ticks box two for me.
Yeah. It's very Minority Report-ish, like that he could predict what someone's going to do. I mean, with profiling, perhaps, but it's not ever guaranteed and definitely not enough to sentence somebody to death.
No, yeah. And that's, I mean, his demeanor was very friendly. They said he was quite tall, but that East Texas drawl.
Mm-hmm.
And this, they said he was very peppy and cheery in elevators and just would always be like, how's it going? Hi, y'all. How's it going? So then you also have a guy up there that's like, well, yeah, I've seen a lot of them like him. And I'll tell you what, he's one of the worst ones. Mm-hmm. And it's like, bitch, you say that majority of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the jury don't know that.
Randall Dale Adams was convicted in 1976 of killing a Dallas police officer. Adams vehemently denied involvement. Gregson testified with certainty that Adams was a severe sociopath and swore, as he almost always did when called to testify, that the defendant would absolutely kill again, even in prison. Sentenced to death, Adams would spend the next 12 years behind bars. Gregson never even interviewed him. The doctor continued testifying to the assured future dangerousness of defendants, in some cases without ever speaking with them, while in other cases by utilizing information he gleaned from their exams. In 1981, the U.S. Supreme Court declared this latter approach unconstitutional when Ernest Benjamin Smith's case went to the nation's highest court in Estelle v. Smith. The court ruled that using information learned in a competency exam against a defendant in the penalty phase violated the defendant's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. It also violated his Sixth Amendment right to counsel, as Smith's competency exam had been conducted without his attorney's knowledge.
Much like Ernest Benjamin Smith, you get arrested before you even have an attorney appointed to you. They're now evaluating you for competency, so you don't have anyone going, hey, by the way, whatever you say in this, it could be used against you. And also, they're eliciting statements from you that they then will use against you, and you haven't been told that. And also, that all is a necessary, it's at odds to be able to tell a psychiatrist all of your secrets and also not incriminate yourself at the same time.
Yeah.
Because that psychiatrist is literally on the payroll of the state.
Luckily, this no longer goes on. But back then, 70s were loose, man.
Right. And it's like, it takes it going all the way to the Supreme Court to go, yeah, we probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, nobody could figure this out before then, guys. But like with so many wrongful conviction cases, people just want somebody to lock up, especially if it's a person of color. And this was an easy way to go about that.
Mm-hmm. Sinisterhood will be right back.
Gregson was formally reprimanded by the American Psychiatric Association, or APA, for his actions in the case. However, the doctor continued his work, predicting the, quote, future dangerousness of defendants with his newly preferred tactic, solely relying on hypotheticals devised by prosecutors to make his assessments and never meeting with defendants.
And he was very grinning about this. He would be like, I got a reprimand letter. I got a letter from the APA that said I was reprimanded if he was asked on cross about this. Because even if he got, after he got reprimanded, he continued to testify. And he was very, they said he was like LBJ, kind of like a cowboy that was like, oh yeah, that, yeah, I got, they sent me a letter, whatever you want to call that. Mm-hmm. So even though this professional organization is like, don't do these things, he's just like, I did nothing wrong. And you know what? Fine. We'll just change the rules. I'll just play a new game.
And a jury, knowing that, even still has the charm and the expertise mm-hmm. to convince them. Prosecutors would present lengthy hypothetical scenarios that included all the facts of the underlying case. They would then ask Grigson if someone who resembled the person in the hypothetical had a likelihood of future dangerousness. Despite never examining the defendants, Grigson would testify with absolute certainty about their potential for future violence. As he did time and again, Grigson declared in one trial,
there is no question, no doubt whatsoever, that the individual you described will commit acts of violence in the future.
Juries were convinced and almost always voted to sentence the defendant to death.
And that's what they said. Like, once you as the juror hear a 45-minute hypothetical that literally is just the facts of the case, and the one question at the end of the hypo is, and the person I'm talking to, and you get that answer again, like a juror, you're like, oh yeah, that guy's like a brilliant genius. And he seems really like he seems like one of us country.
I don't know that you can ever say there is no doubt whatsoever with 100% certainty. No one can say that about anything.
Like you said, unless you're a Minority Report and you're a remote viewer and you've like seen these people's future. And that's a lie to me. But he would say, in my professional opinion, it is this. And the whole system would just nod and go, and the defense attorneys would go, man, he's good. And it's like, well, that shouldn't even be allowed.
Yeah. He's good at what? Bullshitting? So am I, but I'm not going to get on the stand and sentence somebody to death because of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like going, I think that kid over there is going to grow to be, you know, 8 feet tall. I know it. Well, it's like, well, by the time he grows, however he's going to grow, you're going to either be dead and gone or retired or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you can just say whatever you want and be like, it's absolutely true, and take your money and leave.
And wash your hands of it mm-hmm. and never think about it again. Mm-hmm. Grigson's reputation went nationwide with a 1981 write-up in Time magazine describing his methods, titled,
They Call Him Dr. Death.
The piece detailed his controversial role in capital murder trials, where his expert testimony frequently determined the fate of defendants. By that time, Grigson had testified in over 70 capital cases, with his assessments of, quote, future dangerousness almost always leading juries to unanimously recommend the death penalty. His nickname, Dr. Death, reflected his pivotal role in securing death sentences and the fearsome reputation he had cultivated in courtrooms across Texas.
Not anymore. He's not Dr. Death anymore.
No, he is Dr. No Longer Living.
Yeah, but I'm saying he was dethroned by Christopher Dunst, the other Dr. Death.
Oh, who also is from Texas.
Damn it.
What the fuck is going on?
He did crimes here. Yeah, that's... That might be one we could cover just from one. Upsetting though. Yeah.
That the Dr. Death podcast, phenomenal.
So good.
One of the most
visceral
ones describing those surgeries that I've ever heard.
It really is. But it sucks that we have two Dr. Deaths that we have to go, the other one.
The other Dr. Death. George Dix, a law professor at the University of Texas, said of Grigson,
he's skillful and persuasive, and he doesn't talk down to the jury.
Dix added that Grigson's most notable trait was his willingness
to make firm predictions about a defendant's future behavior.
His credentials and self-assuredness resonated with juries, falsely convincing them they were getting insight into some of the nation's most criminal minds.
Yeah. I mean, he just goes on there and goes like, 100% it's true. You would just believe him.
I think if you preface it with, in my professional opinion, then you can get away with a lot. It's like, allegedly, ..
Yeah, or da-da-da-da-da, question mark.
Based on the evidence of the case, .. So if you set it up where like, well, I'm just saying I think that, not that it's really like written in the stone that my family used to sell mm-hmm. to the people wanted to bury themselves under.
Regarding his confidence in diagnosing dangerousness, Grigson told Time, During an hour of examining a defendant's past and searching for remorse, he can determine the likelihood of future violence.
While he did admit that about a third of the time, his pretrial interviews convinced him there was hope for the defendant, in which case he would not testify for the prosecution, he said of other defendants,
"Some prisoners really get their rocks off telling you about these horrible crimes."
Which is probably true, but also, let's not gloss over the fact that he admits about a third of the time, and then he doesn't testify for the prosecution because that's who he's getting paid by.
Yeah, he's like, suddenly, oh, well, I'm not available. He was also available to defense attorneys, but oftentimes prosecuting offices would just try to, you know, call him first or, you know, get him involved so that you could kind of elbow other people out of using him.
The article also highlighted the growing criticism Grigson faced from the legal and psychiatric communities. Despite this backlash, Grigson's reputation only grew as his confident testimony provided jurors with the psychological assurance that they needed to justify capital punishment. Most notably, the publication thrust Grigson into the national spotlight, cementing his status as both a feared and polarizing figure. From that point on, Grigson's name became synonymous with the harsh application of the death penalty and the complex role of expert witnesses in the courtroom.
And especially around this time where the death penalty had been halted in all states and then brought back, and then you're reading Time magazine going, they've got like an express lane in Texas where this guy will just show up and go, yep, take him out, take him out, take him out.
How embarrassing for our state.
For our fucking whole state, right? Yeah. No, I mean, truly, and it would make, I think, make people afraid to be in Texas or live in Texas.
Well, I mean, you might not be wrong about that, especially if, you know, you were someone that might be in a vulnerable population that could be targeted by the police. You don't want to be in a state where, like, shit, if I get picked up for something I didn't even do and this guy comes on the stand, I could be getting the chair.
Right. And it's also after he came, he was first reprimanded by the APA. So it's like, you've already once been reprimanded by this professional organization, and yet you're just, I mean, not doing the same exact behavior, but still with that same zeal. And then you have to go like, well, you can now just sentence someone to death based on this whole hypothetical.
Yeah. It's real gross too for prosecutors to use someone who they know has been dinged by the APA, who is the, you know, umbrella organization over his entire industry. It's embarrassing that you'd be like, well, we're just going to mention that briefly up top and then we won't mention it again. And then we'll get the sentence we want.
Right. And it literally is up to him just being charismatic to go, oh, don't worry about that.
Yeah. Grigson's testimony carried immense influence, with defense attorneys describing him as a, quote, killing machine, and prosecutors praising his charisma and ability to sway juries. However, his methods were widely criticized within the psychiatric community. In 1983, the APA submitted an amicus brief to the U.S. Supreme Court in another case involving Grigson's predictions, Barefoot versus Estelle. The professional organization criticized Grigson's testimony, stating that
psychiatric predictions of long-term future dangerousness are wrong in at least 2 out of every 3 cases.
They argued that such testimony gave jurors a
false aura of certainty and impermissibly distorts the fact-finding process in capital cases. 2 out of 3 is a lot.
2 out of 3 is more than half. You know?
And that's what he's batting.
And half would be too much. Like, this isn't, the stakes aren't low. The stakes are the highest they could be.
Yes.
You're being sentenced to death. When the stakes are that high, my dude, you can't be just like 25% sure. What are we at?
33%? Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, whatever.
But I mean, truly.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you can't, and neither can the prosecution.
Yes,
I would hire someone that's going to say these lies on the stand.
Exactly. And it's like the jurors should be told that of like, he's going to tell you this. You should know that in 66% of the cases, he's wrong.
Yeah.
So are you willing to kill someone who is wrong 66% of the time?
And if you framed it, if they got to hear it like that, I don't think they would, because it really makes it pretty clear. Like, this person's life is literally in your hands. Are you going to believe this guy when he's wrong 66% of the time? But like with anything, you just kind of spin it to make it a positive.
Totally. It's framing it that way. Mm-hmm. Of like, well, yes, of course you can't. But wouldn't you feel bad if he did go on and kill someone else?
Of course.
Blood would be on your hands.
But I'd also feel bad if I sentenced him to death and he was innocent. So, you know, that's the tough role that the jurors play.
Sinisterhood. We'll be right back.
In the Barefoot case, the Supreme Court disagreed with the APA and held psychiatric testimony predicting defendant's future dangerousness could be admissible in the penalty phase of a capital trial, even if the predictions were based on hypotheticals and lacked absolute scientific certainty. The court rejected the argument that such testimony violated due process, stating that it was up to the jury to weigh the credibility of the evidence. The majority opinion acknowledged the APA's criticism that such predictions were wrong 2 out of 3 times, but concluded that their fallibility did not render the testimony inadmissible, likening it to other forms of expert evidence with inherent uncertainties.
Yeah, reading the decision, you're just like, wait, but like he's saying 100% sure, and it's not 100%. No. And they're like, well, the jury can decide.
50% of the time, it works 100% of the time. Yes. You know, it's.
What are you talking about?
Again, like I just said, jurors have a very difficult job, but they're also not the experts here. So if the jurors who are lay people are hearing from, quote, experts, false stuff, how can the juror be blamed for giving a sentence that wasn't deserved, but that's what they thought was the right thing to do?
100%. This is why I think Judge Christie, the shirt I'm currently wearing.
I've been the judge in any of these cases.
But truly, I was going to say, this is why, I mean, I think that your reasoning is, it's in line with the dissent we're about to discuss. And also with, I think, common morals of everyone to, and also common sense to say, of course, a layperson is going to be swayed. Therefore, it should not be allowed that this expert swaying those lay people, the expert should not have access to these tools and methods of impermissible, what I would think is impermissible swaying, because you're setting up the jurors to fail. And then the Supreme Court in this case just went, they'll figure it out. Spoiler alert. No, they won't.
How would they?
Yeah.
They're everyday people that don't, they're not in the law field. You know what I mean? Like, they're not going to figure this out. They're hoping that you, the professionals, are there to help them figure it out.
Right. And as a juror, you think, God, I've got to do something so difficult, whether to send this person to the death penalty or not. And they want to say, well, I'm relying on this guy. Mm-hmm. And he seems like a nice guy. Mm-hmm. He's funny and he's kind of sweet. He's a cute little old man. Like, I don't know. I feel better about sentencing someone to death because the expert said it. So it's wild that the Supreme Court's like, the jurors will figure it out. I'm like, bitch, have you ever had jury duty? Like, take 5 seconds to think about if you're just like a busy person doing jury duty and you're like, I'm not allowed to go study this. I have to only do what's in front of me.
True. Once you start hearing the case, you're not even allowed to go look stuff up.
Wow.
So you couldn't figure, even if you had a question and you're like, well, I have a question, I guess I'll ask the court. Well, if the court is biased, then guess what happens?
Tough shit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In a scathing dissent, Justice Harry Blackmun wrote that
the specious testimony of a psychiatrist colored in the eyes of an impressionable jury by the inevitable untouchability of a medical specialist's words equates with death itself.
Despite the dissent, Dr. Death's practice of using hypothetical testimonies in capital cases was effectively upheld. Shame, shame, shame.
I mean, this is the importance of dissents, though. You know, it's like to show
good
like.
For Justice Blackmun. Bad for everybody else.
Right.
Throughout the 1980s, Grigson continued his practice of testifying in capital cases. He earned around $200,000 per year in his private practice, plus $150 per hour for his many hours of expert testimony. Eventually, his services were so coveted, some DA's offices and defense law firms put Grigson on retainer to keep him from being available to the opposing side.
Yeah, you'd hear one attorney was like, I've done 6 capital cases and 4 of them he's worked with me on them and I've never lost a case. Like, and I've always gotten the death penalty. I'm like, I'm sure all of them were executed because of you.
And as for him, as far as like money goes, to be on retainer, that's a sweet gig. Because you're not even having to work a lot of the times and you're getting paid just so you don't go work for somebody else.
And he was that good. And obviously, an indigent client is never going to get his help because he does charge this much. But for a wealthy client, if you could get a hold of him early enough, then they would keep the prosecution from using him. But the prosecution figured that out and started going, you are permanently our expert. So therefore, you are conflicted out of helping any defendants in this area. And now you have what is like a secret weapon. That's why the killing machine, I think, is a great term for it because it really does prevent anybody from accessing his quote unquote services, which are not fair. So
yeah,
it's like double inequities. It's inequitable that he even exists in the first place, but you can't even use him to help you.
Mm-hmm. While his career was booming, those he had condemned, like Randall Dale Adams, languished in jail. Soon, though, the truth would come to light. Directed in 1988 by Errol Morris, The Thin Blue Line was a groundbreaking documentary that exposed flaws in the American justice system and ultimately led to the exoneration of Adams, a man wrongfully convicted for the 1976 murder of Dallas police officer Robert Wood. The film combined investigative journalism with dramatic reenactments, uncovering a series of inconsistencies, false witness testimony, and judicial misconduct that contributed to Adams' wrongful conviction. Grigson had played a pivotal role in securing Adams' death sentence. Have you watched this? Did we watch this on DocuWorry?
Well, I don't know if we watched it for DocuWorry. I have watched it, and I know you've watched it. You actually recommended it to me, and that's why I watched it.
I thought we watched it on the very first DocuWorry, but perhaps that was so long ago, I don't remember.
If you have not seen it, it is definitely
a groundbreaking documentary that really changed the way that they're covered, and it was done in a more ethical way, especially at the time. It's fantastic. Highly recommend it to everybody.
And it definitely highlights, I feel like this whole case highlights, that Dr. Grigson was willing to say with 100% certainty that someone, A, was a killer, and he was only brought in the penalty phase, so he didn't even really contribute to this wrongful conviction, which was for all the myriad reasons covered in the film, but he would just come in and go, that guy definitely is a killer and will kill again. And it's like, he wasn't even there.
He was picked up by the guy that killed him and was just in the passenger seat. They didn't even know each other.
But yeah, it's like, that's even further proof.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he doesn't care.
Originally, Morris set out to investigate Grigson's questionable methods, but his research led him to Adams's case, which appeared to be a textbook example of wrongful conviction. Following the film's release, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals overturned Adams' conviction in 1989, and he was released after spending 12 years in prison, several of which were on death row. Even still, Grigson insisted Adams was guilty and doubled down on his claim that Adams
will kill again
in later testimony. Adams was never compensated for his wrongful conviction. He spent his post-release as an activist against the death penalty and wrote a book about his experiences. The exposure from the film greatly contributed to Grigson's downfall.
And sort of became a question that defense attorneys would ask when they would get up to cross-examine him and be like, Dr. Grigson, so have you ever heard of the Randall Dale Adams case? Mm-hmm. And it's like, it goes to his credibility, and that's on the stand anytime. He'd be like, they got it wrong. They let a murderer out on the street. I'm the only one that's keeping the public safe. So even though he had an actual wrongful conviction that's proven that this person did not do it, he would not back down on the stand. He still went back down.
That's the hubris of man.
Yes.
That, like, you just dig in, and you are, even if you think there's a little inkling that you're wrong in your brain,
never.
You'll be goddamned if you're going to admit that you're wrong, because it shows weakness, or it means you don't get hired as much. You're not on retainer anymore.
Probably definitely that. And also then it goes to question all of the cases in which you've said 100% sure this.
Mm-hmm. In 1989, the Supreme Court decided Penry versus Lanaugh, ruling Texas's death penalty statute was unconstitutional when juries lacked adequate instructions to consider mitigating evidence, such as a defendant's intellectual disabilities or a history of abuse. In response, Texas amended its capital sentencing statute in 1990 to explicitly require jurors to weigh such evidence when determining a death sentence.
So then you have more experts coming in to argue whether or not someone's intellectual disabilities should be considered mitigating. So you know Dr. Grigson is cracking his knuckles like, I'm ready to tell you that this person is so dangerous, and also they know exactly what they're doing despite any IQ evidence to the contrary.
That same year, Grigson testified at the Dallas murder trial of Galen Bradford, whose defense argued his IQ of 75 qualified him as intellectually disabled. In a rare occurrence, Grigson was allowed to personally examine Bradford. The doctor dismissed the low IQ score as, quote, bullshit, and aggressively questioned him about the murder and suspected but unproven past crimes. On the stand, Grigson declared Bradford
one of the most dangerous killers I've ever examined,
blending speculation with his usual predictions of future violence.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Texas is very famous for executing people with intellectual disabilities for a long time.
Yeah.
Still a little bit less due to some laws we'll talk about later in the more recent years. But this was, again, a situation where I think Grigson saw an opportunity to be this quote unquote expert and was happy to change his testimony, not only to extend to the dangerousness, but to prove that this person had done past crimes. He's like, I know it. I know he's a killer. I just know it by looking at him. It should be noted that Grigson was white. Galen Bradford was black. And Grigson's just like, I just know in me he's killed before. I can
that
just tell.
Isn't how this works,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah.
Hold on. I forgot what I was going to say. I believe the full quote was about his IQ. That's bullshit. I know he's smarter than that, or I know it's higher than that. And then when they asked, well, how do you know? Well, from things I've heard.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
What are you talking about?
You can't, that's not, none of this is, it's wild when you, it's like a kangaroo court, but with the highest stakes ever. And when you like zoom out, it's wild to imagine this happening for so long, but it did.
No, and I think it makes you examine kind of like the machinations of our criminal justice system, because you from afar think, well, there's checks and balances. And certainly like people look into these things before someone's just like sentenced to death. And you're like, oh, yeah, they're looked into because someone just felt it.
Yeah, just felt it. You know what? I have a lot of feelings, too. I call them an empath. That doesn't mean go on the stand and be like 100% certain that man's going to kill again when you don't even know if he ever has killed, first of all.
True. Also that.
Defense attorney Paul Brockley challenged Grigson's objectivity. On the stand, Grigson had ridiculed Bradford's lightning bolt haircut, saying,
it's the weirdest haircut I'd ever seen.
On cross, Brockley responded,
pretty good reason to kill him, right?
Though the remark highlighted Grigson's potential bias, the jury ultimately accepted his testimony, sentencing Bradford to death.
And yeah, Bradford had a flat top with what, if you look at pictures now, you kind of go, that's not really shocking. But in 1989, it was kind of this like cutting edge, cool guy haircut, because it was like a flat top fade with lightning bolts in the side.
Mm-hmm.
And very interesting that Grigson, I don't say interesting, but it's like almost he sort of let this bias slip out loud, because it's like, you know, it's a bias that he has. But he's like, you know, he's a killer. Just look at his hair.
Yeah. Which?
What?
What, sir? Are you telling us to consider how a black man looks as reason for sentencing him to death?
Yeah, because he has a hip hairstyle or whatever. So I appreciate that the defense attorney really called it out as loudly as he did. And the journalist covering this kind of said, you know, there was this kind of in the room.
Mm-hmm.
But then Grigson is able to kind of bring it back still with that gregarious, like, oh, you know, he's just picking on me, y'all. And you see that bias of the jurors.
I hate it.
Sinister Hood will be right back.
Bradford's was the third case the doctor testified, and over the course of just two working days, the marathon of testimony was captured by Ron Rosenbaum, a writer for Vanity Fair, in the article, Travels with Dr. Death. The piece was highly critical of Grigson's methods, portraying him as a, quote, traveling salesman for the death penalty, rather than a legitimate forensic psychiatrist. The article exposed how frequently he testified without conducting proper psychiatric evaluations, relying instead on a formulaic approach that guaranteed damning conclusions for defendants. Rosenbaum described Grigson's reputation for influencing holdout jurors, ensuring they fell in line with the death sentence. In one case, he identified a female juror who appeared skeptical, sitting with her legs crossed, seemingly dismissive of the prosecution's psychiatric testimony. Recognizing the risk of a hung jury, Grigson alerted the prosecutor, who then used the juror's questionnaire to find personal details about her. Specifically, they discovered that she had a 14-year-old daughter. Armed with this information, Grigson returned to the stand and was asked whether the defendant was
the kind of man who would rape and kill a 14-year-old girl.
As the line of questioning unfolded, the woman uncrossed her legs, a subtle but telling shift in Grigson's mind. The jury then voted unanimously for death.
So now you're gaslighting jurors.
This is some shady ass shit, but I imagine this probably goes on a lot, right?
Well, I will say, apparently he was coveted because he would do these things and other psychiatrists did not do stuff like this.
Oh, like watch the jury yes. and then alert the prosecutors?
Yes. Yeah. Like he would, they were like, he is like a jackhammer. He doesn't want to lose. I think he had a lot riding on his stakes as like, being on retainer with these mm-hmm. district attorney's offices of like, well, I can't like go in and lose. So if he saw anything from the corner of his eye, and he would almost play chess against himself because he would also watch the defense attorney's psychiatric testimony, you know, whatever expert they had up there, and then would tell the prosecution, which is, that's normal to say, okay, these are ways you could poke holes in it. Mm-hmm. But so above and beyond, that's what the statement of a lot of attorneys that liked him or either didn't like him would be like, he goes like way beyond.
He goes hard.
Way
and in the wrong direction.
Yes. Yeah. To think that you're like, well, how old is her daughter? Well, we'll just paint a picture in the mind of the horrific damage to her daughter. And then she'll go with me.
And it works. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. It's, I don't want to brag, but when I served on the jury, I was told afterwards by the prosecution that I was the strongest juror because they could not tell from my face or demeanor which way I was going to lean.
Nice.
But that's, you kind of got to do that. Even mm-hmm. though sometimes you hear stuff that you possibly couldn't, but you know, they are watching and mm-hmm. your voice is the only one that really matters at the end of the day. And to know that they can use like personal things you've said against you in this type of way is nauseating.
It's eerie. And especially mm-hmm. coupled with, he would always say, oh, I'm objective. I am not testifying for the defense or for the prosecution. I'm just here to tell the truth.
Bullshit. Who's paying
you? Yes. Me? Yeah. I mean, that's a powerful message, especially if it's given the specifics of your personal life that you don't know that it's the specifics of your personal life. It just so happens to be a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah. You're like, oh my gosh. You don't even think like they probably mm-mm. went and knew that I had a 14-year-old daughter and they're saying that. You just hear, that could be me. And mm-hmm. then death.
Right.
Despite its damning portrayal, the Vanity Fair piece humanized Gregson through small personal details that painted him as more than just Dr. Death. Described his charming, almost old-fashioned Southern manner, including the plush Cadillac he drove between trials, his delight in a good steak dinner after a day of testifying, and his passion for the erotic Lambada dance style. At home, he was a devoted father, playing with his kids on the floor. Described as perpetually grinning and relentlessly gregarious, Gregson even shared his life philosophy with the writer, explaining,
I try every day to make at least one person's life a little better, a little brighter.
That's your credo? That's
it. It's eerie, man. I mean, it's wild. They said he was just joking around all the time, that he was at a dinner one time with like all these other attorneys and there was a piano player just kind of like playing background for everyone in the restaurant. And when the piano player finished, he was like, let's get up and give him a round of applause. It'll make his day. So then you have all these attorneys mm-hmm. where it's like, well, Jim's a good dude. Like mm-hmm. he's nice. And we had dinner together. He was funny. Although the Lambada thing, weird. Weird stuff.
I forgot about the Lambada.
Weird stuff. Whatever they said, the writer goes, he talked more about the Lambada than about Galen Bradford before he went to testify that this man was a huge danger. And he would just say like nasty, sexy things to women and be like, you know, in the Lambada, you got to put your thigh all the way up on a man. And the man wraps his arm on your leg. And it's like, we're in a courthouse.
Yeah. The more, you know, you kind of pull at the strings here and it unravels, you see that he's not a good old Southern boy. Well, he actually is a good old Southern boy, but he's not the good kind that we want. He's he knows whose ass to kiss, whose back to scratch, you know, when to turn on the charm and when to turn on the sexual harassment.
Right. And honestly, he was obsessed with saying, oh, this person's a sociopath. This person's a sociopath. And one of the attorneys in the Vanity Fair article, a defense attorney goes, I think he's a sociopath. He's like, I'm not saying that lightly. He's like, it's creepy. He's got like two personalities. And Ron Rosenbaum did an excellent job, I think, of really showing like the banality of evil, of like just them driving down the road, him being like, yeah, I'll probably get them all executed anyway. So in the Lambada, when you put your hand up on the woman's hip and the author's just like talking more about Lambada instead of execution that's impending. Wild. And I think that's like shows the value of like an artist, a writer, somebody like that who is just witnessing.
Mm-hmm.
the truth and just going, this is what this man said.
Yeah.
He also said that every time that the the Vanity Fair guy would get introduced to somebody at the courthouse, Dr. Grigson, go, Ron's down here to do an expose on your sex life. And the writer's like, no, I'm not. And the people are like, I know, he just does jokes like that.
He just does jokes like that. And we all just laugh it off because he's the funny Dr. Death. Jokes like that, I mean, I think we've come kind of a long way, maybe a short distance from then now. Mm-hmm. But back then, like,
all the time.
Sexual harassment jokes like that, like, they're just left and right. Fly out of anybody's mouth. It didn't matter what the profession was.
Right. I was glad that the writer, even though it was 1990, was like, and then he said these like weird and appropriate things to women. I'm like, thanks, man. But you hear it in the quotes from Grigson in that article of, I used to get conned by these people. It's like he decides before he goes in that these are a dangerous criminal. And basically they just have to say something to prove me wrong.
Yeah. And the question is, why? Like, what, mm-hmm. what happened in, or maybe it's just like your desire for power and greed and money that you're willing to like literally take somebody else's life without even thinking much about it. And you're so dug in that you got to be right about it.
Yeah. And I think when he talks about one of the cases in a Dallas case where a guy was, he testified that the guy would be dangerous. The guy was still let out. And then once the guy was let out, he attacked a teenager in a very violent, vicious way. And the way that Grigson like pulls that case mm-hmm. up, I was like, you need to deal with your own trauma. Like, you are going hard on all of these defendants trying to get them executed because you feel guilty that that guy got out. And it's like, it wasn't your fault, man. Like, the jury did what the jury did, but it's like he course corrected and was like, that one girl was hurt mm-hmm. because I didn't testify good. He never says that out loud, but just him bringing it up, I'm like, I'm no psychiatrist, but
there's probably something there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. surely.
Rosenbaum wrote how Grigson brought an unusually personal zeal to cases like those in his two-day marathon, suggesting Grigson was determined to see defendants like Galen Bradford executed. Once again, the article exposed Grigson's excessive confidence and unscientific methods, reinforcing the broader pattern of his career, his predictable and damning testimony in death penalty cases, regardless of mitigating factors or actual psychiatric evidence. As one prosecutor told the magazine,
defense lawyers fear Dr. Grigson. They fear his effect on juries, his demeanor, his sincerity. His charisma is absolutely uncontrollable by the defense. It drives him crazy. And he just, like I said, he wanted to play chess with himself. Galen Bradford, the other expert, he watched him and then told the Vanity Fair guy, oh, if I could have gotten Galen Bradford off. He's like, I'll tell you what you say is you say X, Y, and Z. So it's like he just would say whatever the person paying him would tell him to say.
It almost like it's a game.
Yeah.
Like a mental game for himself of how can I win? I don't really care what the truth is. I just want to win.
And you feel like God too. Like I could have let him live or die, but I chose to kill him.
True.
It's eerie. Yeah.
It is very eerie. Sociopathic, one might say.
Indeed.
In 1995, the American Psychiatric Association expelled Grigson, citing his unethical conduct and false certainty in predicting future dangerousness. The release of The Thin Blue Line contributed to this decision. The Texas Society of Psychiatric Physicians followed suit, further discrediting his standing in the medical community. Grigson's credibility was permanently damaged, though he remained unapologetic about his role in death penalty cases. Grigson fought the expulsion with a lawsuit, but was unsuccessful. After controversy over his testimony in criminal cases reduced demand for his services, Dr. Grigson shifted to focusing on civil law cases, but still testified in some criminal cases.
My jaw was on the ground when I saw the 1997 case with James Grigson testifying to future dangerousness, and I'm like, huh?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
We've known this for a long time. That's not the dude to call.
And they still called him. And you know, it's like if you can slip it in under a jury's nose without them judging him, they did it.
How can they do that, though, if he has lost his license?
He's a paid expert. He's not practicing medicine. Mm. He has the credentials. And then again, it's up to the jury to decide the credibility of a person who lost his credentials. And if they say,
they skirt over that a lot, or maybe even bring it in, you know?
Right. When the defense goes, you're the guy from The Thin Blue Line, right? And he's like, yeah. And they let a dangerous criminal out. And they go, and you're the one that lost his license, right? And it's like, those liberals just hate the death penalty. Mm-hmm. The APA is a bunch of like liberals. They're not even from here. And the jury's like, yeah, they are. And then it's like, it worked. It's like he felt like the type that would say whatever he could to get his way, which again sounds like a sociopath.
Grigson retired in 2003 after a career spanning over four decades, with his testimony having contributed to the execution of more than 100 people. In 2004, he passed away from lung cancer at the age of 72, leaving behind a legacy that remains deeply divisive. While prosecutors praised his expertise and ability to communicate effectively with jurors, critics viewed him as a menace to justice, arguing that his certainty in life-or-death cases led to wrongful executions. Dr. Death was dead, but the impact of his actions lived on. While some cases involving his testimony were overturned due to prosecutorial or procedural misconduct, other defendants were executed or are still waiting for their execution date. Jeffrey Wood is one defendant still tied to Grigson. Currently on death row, Wood's case has drawn significant attention due to his minimal role in the underlying crime. Wood was convicted and sentenced to death in 1998 under Texas's Law of Parties for his involvement in a 1996 robbery during which his co-defendant fatally shot a convenience store clerk. Wood neither pulled the trigger nor planned the murder. At sentencing, as he had hundreds of times before, Grigson responded to a hypothetical scenario presented by the state, asserting that Wood would pose a future threat to society were he not sentenced to death. As of 2025, Wood remains on death row without a scheduled execution date.
In 2021, the Texas House had passed legislation that would prevent someone convicted under the Law of Parties from being sentenced to death, given that they are not the actual person taking a life. It did not pass the Texas Senate and, of course, did not become law. But there is some movement toward getting rid of laws that would see someone executed for being present when there was a crime committed.
Yeah, an accomplice. Yeah. And he would had several cases where the jury stayed the execution, or you know, but you still remain on death row, which is wild that you can go to trial and they're like, no, but then you just get sent back
over and over again. Yeah. And sometimes people wait 10, 20 years before they're executed because of all these appeals. So that becomes the question and the danger of like, well, you are on the verge of changing this law. Why am I getting executed for a law that's not going to, well, it's like, well, we haven't changed it yet. Yeah, but you're close.
Yeah. And why can't you, let's speed it up. Cause you know, you could, if you wanted to.
Right. Sinisterhood will be right back.
Over time, courts have become more cautious about admitting speculative expert testimony in capital cases, and professional organizations, such as the American Psychiatric Association, have reinforced the importance of adhering to scientific rigor in forensic psychiatry. In 2005, Texas introduced life imprisonment without parole as an alternative to the death penalty, providing juries with more discretion in sentencing. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Moore v. Texas in 2017 mandated that Texas adhere to contemporary clinical standards when assessing intellectual disability in capital cases.
Yeah, and it's been heartening to see both Supreme Court precedent as well as practice in Texas courts leaning more toward actual legitimate forensic tests and like levels of proof. But you still, 2 out of 3, you can't necessarily say to a degree of medical certainty they are dangerous. You can say, here are some factors that might contribute. You as the jury can decide. There was a guy named Dr. Richard Coons who, very similar to Grigson, would be like, I've developed my own methodology that I can determine with certainty if someone was dangerous.
And then he pulled out his crystal ball.
Yes. He was like, it's called a magic eight ball. It's from Walmart in the children's section. Watch. Hang on. Outcome not determined. Let me check it again. Hold on. So it's like, I believe it was the defense attorney in that case went, his entire whole deal was, trust me, I'm a doctor. Like that's literally, there's no actual methodology here. But that guy testified in 150 cases. And that wasn't until 2010 that Dr. Coons's testimony was found to be unreliable. And a different forensic psychologist was Dr. Walter Quijano. He would testify that race was determinative.
Oh boy.
So they would say, okay, why do you think this person is a danger? The case that turned over finally got Quijano, Quijano, out
not
of
Keanu.
We're not Reeves.
Smirching the Listen, wonderful Keanu.
Keanu Reeves would never. But the case was a 1997 case that did not make it to the Supreme Court until 2017. But in that case, the prosecutor said, you've determined that sex as a factor of dangerousness, that men are more violent than women. Now, the race factor, black, that increases the future dangerousness for various complicated reasons. Is that correct? And he went, yes. And they went, okay. And he said that repeatedly. For
various complicated reasons.
Yes, for various complicated reasons, being black makes you more violent. Being Hispanic, Latino makes you more violent. According to this doctor who testified in more than one, like any amount of cases, such that it finally got overturned. And it took, I think, time after that for people to stop using him. But again, you see, the argument from the state of Texas, by the way, was, well, the race thing was only like a line or two. And the defense attorney was like, yeah, but it's like real important.
It could have been the determining factor indeed. In sentencing someone to death, and probably often was.
Yes, she basically said, like, race as dangerousness, that link is so ingrained and so pernicious in the history and culture of the death penalty. It's crazy. And she said, regardless of how many lines of transcript it occupies, it's that big of a deal.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and the Supreme Court luckily agreed. So
it makes you wonder, because we've now talked about three doctors that were immoral and unethical and did things like this, how many more there have been, or not even just doctors, other expert witnesses, you know, that testify and just say whatever to get the outcome they want.
Right. You see, it's important with a case like Moore v. Texas is contemporary clinical standards, right? Mm-hmm. And not a methodology I thought of on my own.
That sounds like a cult leader.
Yeah, it's wild. Mm-hmm. And then and they're like, can I have my check, please? It's $150 an hour. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Between 1977 and 2017, Texas carried out 546 executions, almost five times as many as Virginia, next leading state, with 113. The Lone Star State has accounted for more than one-third of the nation's total during the modern era of capital punishment. By 2017, both executions and new death sentences in Texas had declined to near historic lows, reflecting evolving legal standards and societal attitudes toward capital punishment. In 2024, Texas ranked second in the nation, carrying out five executions, just one less than the country's leader, Alabama.
And you see, laws like the contemporary clinical standards, that leads to a decline in these death penalty assessments, as does the 2005 ruling that ruled that the use of the death penalty against juvenile offenders age 17 or under is cruel and unusual under the Eighth Amendment. And any of these milestones along the way that sort of just make it more difficult to wholesale point to someone and go, absolutely, they're dangerous for this superficial reason.
Yeah.
I think is you'll see the numbers go down.
I think too, enabling the jurors to just sentence someone to life in prison without parole rather than death.
True.
Jurors, anybody's going to be more likely to do something like that because it doesn't make you feel as bad. So if the death penalty was on the table, would they have gotten it? Is it worse to spend the rest of your life in prison?
Yeah.
An argument can be made for which would you rather do with that?
Right. And as a state, if you're looking at the numbers, it is less costly to sentence to someone to life in prison without parole than it is to assess a capital sentence on them. So it's all those aspects and the elements of it, right? Of like, we shouldn't care how much it costs, and they shouldn't have to have an alternative. Mm-hmm. Like, they should be able to assess yes or no based on these underlying factors. And it still, you can assess future dangerousness on people under the age of 21, which there has been a push since 2020 against that, including the APA and a bunch of members of the Texas legislature wrote a letter saying, established research has definitively proved that it is not scientifically possible to reliably predict future dangerousness in the case of an 18-year-old. You just can't. There's just not enough information.
Their brain hasn't even finished developing.
Yeah. So to have that, it is, to me, that's cruel and unusual under the Eighth Amendment because that is, it's predicated on demonstrably false circumstances.
Yeah, for sure. Dr. James Grigson's career epitomized the intersection of psychiatry and the death penalty, raising critical ethical and legal questions about the role of expert witnesses in capital punishment trials. His sinister influence remains a cautionary tale about the power of expert testimony and its potential to shape or distort justice. So what do we think?
I think it's crazy that in Texas, in order to get sentenced to death, that somebody has to assess your future dangerousness because, in my opinion, it is an unassessable thing. Mm-hmm. That you have a case like there was a gentleman named, I think it was Ramiro Gonzalez, and he was executed last summer in Texas. 18 years ago, he had sexually assaulted and murdered two women. And at the time, was testimony from an expert at the time said, no matter if he's in jail or not, he is violent, unrehabilitatable. He's just, you throw him away. He's done. Now, of course, with all the appeals, he's been in jail. He had been in jail before he was executed for 18 years. Mm-hmm. And over the course of 18 years, either he was a very good actor or he truly became an extremely committed Christian. He became a minister. He would minister to others behind bars. He would act as a counselor to others behind bars. He tried to donate his kidney. Of course, that was complicated given like where, you know, he was in jail and stuff. But his attorneys were like, he has truly that he was remorseful about the victims, that he thought about them. He spoke about them. He wrote about, he said, I've torn something from the world that can never be replaced. Mm. I will never get over this guilt. All I want to do is try to make the world better because of what I've done. I was so young. I can't believe I made such a horrific decision. And these are all the things you would want a rehabilitated criminal to say. And the person that assessed him 18 years ago before he was executed said, I made a hasty decision. I diagnosed him with antisocial personality disorder. I relied on recidivism data. Then that data that I relied on was actually incorrect. And I evaluated him later and he actually did not have that disorder. And I would argue that he would not be a danger now. And the state of Texas went, too bad, so sad. You said what you said. And they put him to death last June. So you can kind of see how these, even someone who done a horrible crime, it's like, what if the purpose is simply just to punish people, then just take them out back, you know?
But why keep them in prison? Just do it right away if that's the end game.
But then it's like, or are we trying to heal something? And you want someone to have that, oh my God, I would in my life never hurt a fly again.
Yeah.
But then we executed him anyway, right?
Yeah. It does make you question, what is the purpose of prison? They like to say it's rehabilitation, but then even when someone shows rehabilitation, it doesn't matter when the stakes are higher than the highest they could possibly be. Mm-hmm. And you even have the person that said that originally come back and be like, I'm just human. I also made a mistake. I shouldn't have rushed to decisions. And you're also held accountable for something you said 18 years ago that like you can't change your opinion as you learn more too.
No, and it's true. And like you said, we don't know the breadth of psychiatrists and psychologists that are willing to testify and what they're saying and the underlying data. Like this person said, well, I use recidivism data. Turns out it was wrong. It's like, could you be right? Because it has to do with kind of like this person's whole future. And also from a victim's advocacy perspective of what is the victim's family looking for? I mean, and is it this person was intellectually disabled and I still want to you know, or is it, I would like to see some type of rehabilitation, but Texas is, like I said, we've been dethroned, as we said, but we are often cited as the state that executes the most people. Mm-hmm. Only the state, United States in general, only China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt conducted more executions in 2022 than the United States. So as a developed and kind of democratic, quote unquote, nation, the amount of people that are incarcerated and the amount of people that we kill, Texas is, you know, like I said, we're the leader of the leader. Yeah.
Nothing we want to be the leader of, that's for sure.
No,
Alabama
not at all.
Alabama has us beat, though, by just one.
1 year. I think we're one of 27 states, and now the federal government as well is bringing back the death penalty, which is what we would like to hear when you have an enemies list, that you are bringing back the death penalty at the federal level. So it's something to be cognizant of as you lobby your legislators, your elected officials near you, like check out what the laws are, what the criterion in your state might be to execute people and what type of data or experts are contributing to that. Many of you probably are lucky enough to live in a place that doesn't execute people. So,
Yep. And if you're on a jury, you know, things get skirted over. Like you're smart. You wouldn't have been picked to be on the jury if you wasn't smart. So don't let them talk so much that your eyes do glaze over because they, that's what they want to happen. They want to lull you into like a little comfortable setting and then drop some bombshell on you after they've kind of won you over, but mm-hmm. don't let them get you.
You're 100%. And evil people might have really stellar credentials. Mm-hmm. Like the devil might have gone to UT Southwestern Medical School. And it sounds like he did, you know, mm-hmm. and that doesn't mean that he's not a really well-trained guy, but he's willing to use that training. As you heard with Galen Bradford, he's like, oh, if I was on the other side, I would have said this and it would have yeah. been perfect. So it's like also being cognizant of who's saying what to you, like you said, when you're a juror.
Which goes to show that he didn't really believe that these, I mean, maybe some, but a lot, no. Because he's like, whoever hires me, I'm just going to prove the case for them. Again, yeah. it's just like winning. It's not about mm-hmm. fact-finding or truth-telling.
100%. I think it was, he wanted to be the winner. He mm-hmm. wanted to be that I get him every time. I get mm-hmm. him every time. And I think that's also why some cases people will come to him and he would go, I'm not going to testify for you, because he didn't think he could. He didn't think he could help.
Yeah.
But yeah, it makes you sick to think about the lives that were lost because of one person's hubris yeah. and ego.
It truly does. Yeah.
And the whole system. Yeah.
It does. And the fact that he was such a fan of the Lambada doesn't help either. He sounds like a kind of a nasty old man perv with women.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The type that's like talking about your sex life. Yeah. Like,
it's like, get out of here, Griggs.
Nah, fuck off. Yeah, get out of here, Griggs. No one likes you. But hopefully now when people Google his name, this will come up. So
yeah. Nice.
Happy. Enjoy your legacy, us. Dr. James Gregson. And may you suck a dick in hell.
Well, if you like our free episodes, you'll love our Patreon bonus content. You can hear a lot more stuff like that. You can join for free to see what we're up to next or dive into over 1,000 hours of segments like True Crime Headlines, Dear Sinister, Judge Christie. We're about to record one right after this.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited, Your Honor.
We got all sorts of stuff. Q&As. Live streams.
When you join, you get so many things like ad-free episodes, monthly live stream Q&As, quarterly live bonus contents, those weekly bonuses that Christy talked about, monthly minisodes, merch discounts, and a community of the best listeners on the whole entire internet.
Yeah, and if you join for free, you still get an archived bonus content sent to you once a month, and there's a whole back catalog of free content on there that you could watch too.
Mm-hmm.
And for recent patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show, and make sure you stick around after our sign-offs to hear your shout-out.
Head to Sinisterhood.com, click shop on the top banner to check out Sinisterhood merch, like t-shirts, mugs, totes, stickers, and even clothes for your kiddos. And don't forget, now through February, we're donating all the proceeds, and we're matching 100% to send the money to California Wildlife Relief Charities. So make sure to head over to Sinisterhood.com, use that Patreon discount code if you'd mm-hmm. like as well, and get that merch to help support the wildfires.
While you're on our website, you can also review the show, follow us on socials, and check out the episode description for sources used during our research. You'll also find fun things like topic-based playlists.
And if you go to sinisterhood.com/liveshows, you can see all the information about Crime Wave at Sea 2025, including information on how to get your fan code. And if you're listening to this after February 7th, it's time to just get your tickets. You got to get your fan code, but still get your tickets. Yeah. And because there's only so many spots to hang out with us.
It's like the Eras Tour. You're going to need to set an alarm. Yeah. You're going to need to, you know, make sure you're ready to go, because who knows how many of these are going to sell.
And it's also like the Eras Tour in that our show is 3 hours long and it spans our entire career. Yeah, no, yeah. I'm kidding. We haven't written it yet, but it'll be great. I promise.
It's from 2018 to present. We go through everything we've ever done personally and professionally.
It's been a long time coming. Well, you can follow us on Instagram.
We need to get our costumes.
Oh my God. All set. And the background, the backup dancers, AKA Tommy Pierce. You can follow us on Instagram and Threads at Sinisterhood Pod. Like us on Facebook at Sinisterhood. Watch full video versions of the Wednesday episodes on YouTube. They're early and ad-free on Patreon. And you can watch clips of the show on TikTok. You can order custom video shout-outs for yourself or the Sinisterhood fan in your life at cameo.com/Sinisterhood. We could say happy birthday, happy anniversary. I love you. congratulations. We're going on the Sinisterhood Crime Wave Tour.
What a way to tell someone.
Hell yeah, that'd be fun.
I love it.
Go to cameo.com and order yours now. Where are you at online?
Oh, I'm going to be all over the place with, I'm trying to do more online, but I never do. So I think the last picture I posted
you do plenty.
Was for my anniversary in November.
You're doing
but
plenty.
You can follow me over on Instagram and Threads and Blue Sky, Christy M. Wallace, and TikTok at Christy or GTFO, where I do repost all sorts of stuff
fire
from
content.
Like wombat, cute wombats to what the latest shit show is that is they call our government.
You do have fire reposts. I can attest. And you can follow me anywhere on the internet at Heather versus the World.
As always, the devil rules the airwaves.
Keep it creepy. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon. Here are your special Patreon shout-outs. Lauren Kazeni.
Ray.
And Mariana Franco.
The Fabulous Three. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. We could not do this without you. We sincerely appreciate you. We hope you pronounce your names correctly. Stay safe, stay healthy, and keep it creepy.
Mwahaha.